Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It's Friday, July 3rd, and you're listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 326. I'm your host, Austin Walker. I'm joined today by Ricardo Contreras.
Hi.
Rob Zachney.
Better to be 3 hours too soon than a minute too late. William Shakespeare, who clearly never dated.
Correct, yeah. And Patrick Klepek.
All right, I need people to write in with their experiences with cotton, candy, grapes, and or wine. We need to know. We spent a lot of time in the pre-show talking about cotton candy, grapes, and wine, and I need someone to weigh in.
What are those? Just wait. You'll find out in like an hour and 25 minutes. Somewhere in that
full
space.
Full circle. I didn't put the request in the pre-show, but
yeah, today we are going to do a deep dive into our question bucket, partially because we've been saying we're going to do one of these for a minute, and then partially because there's like a bunch of stuff we want to hit, but like, what's the format for hitting it? And the answer is y'all already asked us questions related to this. So let me just dive right in. This one comes in from PS, who says, I'm sure I'm not the only person feeling this, but a great deal of the past couple of years have been spent under a degree of existential dread, both because of our political system and now because of the direness of the threat of global warming. I have a note from Austin. This came in before lockdown.
What day? Does you have a date?
I bet I can get a date. I can get a date. Let me just do a search. This comes in. I don't want to tell you. I don't want to tell you the date. Well before lockdown. Well before lockdown.
Like 20, still 2020?
No.
No.
I have found my media consumption changed somewhat. I both lean into the terrible things, reading the collapse subreddit, listening to books and podcasts about global warming, and looking for things that are gentle or at least feel gentle, like Midsummer Murders and The Great British Baking Show. I no longer have an appetite for shows with lots of human drama or emotional suffering because my free time is as limited as it is, doesn't feel up to it. During times when you live under dread, how did your media consumption change? And what kinds of media help you conquer or at least blunt that dread? And I thought this question from November of 2018 was a good one for letting us talk about the sort of stuff we've been watching and reading and thinking about during lockdown. Because I know there's a couple of shows that we've all been hovering around or at least chatting about here or there. The one that we brought up last Monday was The Last Dance, and I don't think yesterday we were considering doing an entire like Waypoints about The Last Dance.
Oh,
and I jokingly
this exchange is terrific.
I said, I don't think that most of us. No, I said I don't think that we have notes, and I haven't watched it since it came out. And Rob has notes.
Of course,
Rob is Rob.
I figured we might want to talk about it at some point. So I just
so you took notes. You took notes contemporaneously at the time that you were watching it?
Yeah.
Incredible.
Patrick, truly. Why do you think I go through like three or four notebooks a year? I take notes on everything.
Amazing.
So this is it. This is our designated moment. We can talk about The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan docu-series that ran on ESPN earlier.
Okay, so
in
here's why this resonated so much. Uh-huh. Like, here's my theory. This is why this thing caught fire. It wasn't just because there's like this bottomless thirst for sports when this came out, also because like the arc of this thing is all 80s and 90s nostalgia. And
100%.
It's about the collapse of an empire. Like, The Last Dance is about how do we go from the boom times of the 80s to the like imperviousness of the 90s Bulls dynasty, to the sudden destruction by choice of that powerhouse. And I think that is one of the, like, subtexts of the entire thing. Like, people, like, one of the reasons this resonates is because you're staring at the 90s Bulls and you're going, like, how did they rise so fast? And how did they fuck it up so quickly? And that is a story we are asking about a lot of things right now. That is a question we're asking about a lot of things right now.
Well, and I think one of the things that's interesting there is I think that there is a naive reading of that show that leaves you with what I think was one of the most well-echoed or most echoed responses. It was like, they definitely had three more seasons in them. They definitely could have kept winning. They definitely could have kept – why didn't they just stay together? They should have just stayed together. And the reason that is naive is because all of the reasons they didn't stay together were very clear, even in this very, like, sweetened up docuseries. There were lots of contradictions at the heart of that team with their relationship with management, with the way that some of the players, like Scottie Pippen, had been paid, with the way that Jordan was treating people. A lot of that stuff, would they have stayed on in a different circumstance? Yes. But the circumstances were not that. And in a similar way, people talk about and think about the 90s of America, to extend your metaphor here, in that same way. It was like, well, why don't we just keep doing that? I was like, well, because there were contradictions at work inside of the 90s of America that were leading to the 2000s. And what you maybe have to do is broaden the scope. You have to not just look at the play on the field. You have to look at what's happening in the back room. You have to look at what's happening around the entire league to again, further the metaphor. But when you look at the whole league, you come to understand that no dynasty could last at that point further, especially one that has a hostile relationship with parts of management that are important, especially one in which major important players are being underpaid and they're the change in what pay looks like across the league has happened such. There will be other offers for that player elsewhere that are more competitive. And frankly, one in which, like, the joy of winning has disappeared, right? Like, there's some of those later wins in that series are just like, yeah, we did it again. Like, I'm happy we did. I'm happy I'm back. I'm happy we did it again. But they don't have that, like, overwhelming celebratory, like, you know, vigor of some of the early wins.
It was a fascinating series to watch because although I would self-describe as a Chicago Bulls fan and that I rooted for that team in the 90s, what was fascinating about the documentary was the realization that, no, I, like, culturally was exposed to the Chicago Bulls and was swept in a local sports team that was extremely successful. And Michael Jordan was at, like, the heart of so much of culture and media at a very specific time and growing up. But I knew fuck all about basketball or the Bulls or their dynamic or even what made them good. That's right. What was, like, so revelatory about watching the series was, like, fundamentally understanding, you know, to the degree that Michael Jordan was willing to expose himself and to the degree that was more of a memoir than it was a documentary, in which Michael Jordan settled old scores. But it was interesting because if you were to ask me prior to watching it, I don't know that I could have described to you too much in detail about the Bulls or Michael Jordan or Scottie Pippen or Horace Grant other than, like, the cultural stuff that had stuck with me. And so actually watching it and seeing the fundamentals of play, that's, you know, at the time that was happening when I was 10, there was no way to internalize that. I could tell you that the triangle existed because I know, because I heard it enough times over the years, but I didn't know what it meant. And so it was actually, like, really fascinating to watch that. Mm-hmm. I thought one of the things that it did well, other than being melodramatic in a gossipy way, was do, like, a pretty decent job of I watched it all with my wife. At first, I was like, do you actually want to watch 9 fucking episodes of this? I could do this on my own. And she was like, no, actually, part of the reason the show was so good is that it's, like, really good at explaining to someone that doesn't really understand basketball or understands, you know, you throw on a ball and it goes in a hoop. Like, how do you explain that to the average person? What made him special, what made the team special, and what made individual players important. That's why I thought the digressions between all the different players and their backgrounds that then explained why they were fundamental to different elements of the team at different points in time were really interesting. I just came away with it, like, as a, like, much more informed on why they were such a special and interesting team, even outside of, like, every episode being, you know, what person Michael Jordan wanted to knock down.
God. The rampant, like, not just beef, but vendetta making that Jordan had is definitely a high
his own
point
myth making
of the show
for, is impressive. Yeah, absolutely, I don't believe 100%. The pizza story at
no,
all.
Not at all.
Not for one
and
fucking
that
second.
People do. To me, is like a sort of collaborative myth-making. They want to believe that. They want to believe the only way that Michael Jordan could get sick in the middle of an important series is if he'd been poisoned by the Utah Jazz.
But also, there's
poisoned.
There's a digression at some point in which they, you know, and you hear this about a lot of long-standing, high-level athletes. You know, it's often mentioned about, you know, folks like Tom Brady, who like sustain a high level of play for a long period of time, in which they have to invent grudges
right.
and slights in order to motivate themselves. And so, you know, like that was the fascinating part about like the pizza store. It's like, well, no, he's just inventing a new version of the same slight to put into the myth. Like he is well, you know, this is something that Kobe Bryant tried desperately to emulate and never quite grasped because it always came across as talented as a player as he was, always came across as a Michael Jordan imitator as opposed to someone on this level, like on the cultural level. Mm-hmm. And it was just really fascinating to see that kind of laid out how he like self-motivated. And I found the bullshit pizza story to just be a natural extension where he's like, ah, fuck it. I'm just going to create a bunch of news stories out of this own myth that maybe he even believes. Maybe he believes it. I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, do you think he believes all of the small little things, the like golf insult or the like someone briefly said something behind your back about how they were going to stop you?
I bet he believes it in the moment and then it's gone and he would admit to you like, yeah, you know, I just needed something.
Yeah.
And I think one of the real this documentary does get a little tedious in places because so much of it is about, and here's how Jordan motivated himself in this incident. And it's always the same story, right? It's always like, and then that really pissed me off. And it's like, okay, it's like watching him charge up his cyan powers, like again and again, like just, oh, here's my petty beef. And then everyone's like, and then he sank a bunch of shots. He really went off. And like,
he's good.
Yeah. Like, I think to me, like, one of the things that really drove, like, even Magic was trying to make it sound fun, but even Magic seemed a little tired of, like, just the guy, right? As he's talking about the Barcelona practice with the Dream Team. And he's just like, he got real pissed and he just played really hard. That's
yeah,
Mike.
It's cool to get your ass beat by Michael Jordan.
Yeah,
now let's do that for nine hours.
And then I think the other part is it ends up, because the show always has to return to Jordan as its central figure, you do end up like, I'd have watched an entire documentary about Dennis Rodman. Like, tell me more about that guy. Tell me more about Phil Jackson's relationship with all these egos and like conflicting players. Like,
and also with worldwide spiritualism and his interest in North American indigenous tribal faith. And Phil Jackson has a lot going. He was a hippie, basically. He was like a hippie basketball player who became the one of the most the winningest coach at this point.
Yes.
His Lakers run was also incredible. So
They kind of just gloss over that as like an interesting personality quirk that allowed him to manage a bunch of personalities without real like I just wanted like pause and be like, can I submit a user question? Why? What got you into this? You know, there must have been a moment.
But Rob, to your point, the fact that they have to stop, they have to come back around to Jordan, is kind of diminishes the breadth of what this could have been.
Yeah.
Also, none of his family not represented at all. I mean, his mother briefly in it.
His mother,
I think
one
of his brothers is briefly in it. But then, I found it like genuinely weird that his children were not featured until the very, very end. Be sort of like a color commentary for like they clearly don't remember much about that era because they were kids. But I just thought it was strange that like for as much as the series spends talking about the myth and the cultural impact and the fact that he was a like beloved cultural figure as opposed to today, which I don't know that you could even have a Michael Jordan like figure like, you know, LeBron's like pretty close, but like, yeah. I don't know. It's just difficult to have people more or less universally love a figure of any regard, like in athletics or otherwise. But I just thought it was a little strange. I mean, they do obviously the gambling stuff, but otherwise, I don't know. They just don't really, there's not much about him in that regard, other than like part of his origin story at the top.
We all read the thing that was it Sports Illustrated or ESPN that did the profile of him when he turned 50.
Yeah, fantastic.
And
piece.
That's the thing, like, you almost need,
none of that's in
yeah,
there.
You need to hold that piece in your mind as you look at him. Because I think to me, like, with that piece in mind, he cuts a sad figure alone in that cavernous living room with the ocean behind him, the whiskey level on that glass rising and falling. But like, you read that piece about him at the age of 50 as he's coming to terms with the fact like he doesn't have it anymore. He has flashes of it, but it's gone. He can't sustain performance. He's an aging man.
What's there's like an anecdote in there where like one of the players came in because he's, you know, the owner of the really terrible Charlotte Hornets. He's been by all accounts like a really, really bad NBA owner. And like one player came in and he was able to like turn it on for like a short, like pickup one-on-one game and just schooled like this, you know, young player. And then the moment it's over, like more or less collapses to the floor and just like it all goes out of him, where like he can just ratchet it up for like this brief moment and show you a bit of like what he was at his peak.
Right.
But by and large, that has, you know, time has taken at him like it does everyone else.
Any other thoughts on the last? I mean, again, we could go. This could be a series. This could be a be good and rewatch it, given the length and depth of it all. I guess my final question here, especially for Rob, who I know is taking a lot of notes, is to the degree that it
respect
it,
the notes.
I do respect the notes. The notes the notes help. As a notes writer, I didn't write notes about this because I didn't think we were going to do this. But as a notes writer, I respect the notes. Where did you come across at the end feeling like it had, I guess earlier you said it was a memoir as much as it was a documentary. And I think all of us on the call recognize that documentaries, that no documentary is a perfect record of knowledge, a perfect record of truth. All documentaries are biased. All documentaries have a perspective and have been edited such to kind of curate a particular narrative. But I'm curious if you have any final takeaways there in terms of what that guiding hand of Jordan was on this thing and to the degree by which it may, there's a generation of people who didn't know Jordan the way we grew up with Jordan. And now they have this. And I'm curious if you have thoughts on in that direction. Because for me, that feels like there's a degree to which he's getting another generation. He's like, this is part of the LeBron Jordan war, but it's also just part of kind of cleansing Jordan's own history and making it, we don't have to talk about the Wizards. We don't have to talk about what happened after this. The end of Jordan's reign was here.
It's not even, the Wizards are not even mentioned in that doc.
No, they're not even mentioned.
This is his chance to say, oh yeah, the story ended here. Oh, right. Oh, that other trilogy? That's the Legends
prequels?
Canon
the prequels,
now.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Yeah, that's not real. I think to a degree that's a big part of it. I think there's a lot of criticism that like the hand of Jordan of this was just too heavy. The documentary just feels too much like a media product for him. I actually think the documentary does a decent job of working within those constraints and pushing against them a little bit. There's a lot of great compromised documentaries, and you can still kind of start getting at some truth even within the, you can only conceal so much, right? Like Jordan wants this to be a image burnishing exercise, but he's kind of a tedious figure in his own documentary. And that can't be concealed because Jordan can't stop being who he is. But I think where it did frustrate me the most was this feeling of everything always has to come back to him. Like, just a small detail. Do you remember how the Rodman stuff's a perfect example. Everything is framed as in Rodman's relationship with Jordan. And the sequences that are recounted, and then Phil Jackson turned to Jordan. Like, in every story, people are just turning to Michael and being like, hey, what should we do here, man? You think Phil Jackson really needed, like, Jordan to weigh in on, like, how to manage the delicate psyches of the personalities around him? It's preposterous. And I think this is one of the things Horace Grant and a couple other people brought up as well. The notion that Jordan was actually the captain of that team in the psychological sense doesn't really hold up. But in that story, he is at the center of everything. It's basically saying, oh, the 90s Bulls, Jordan co-coached that. And that just isn't true.
No, totally. One of the things that I mentioned this on Twitter probably very early on, because the Isaiah Thomas stuff is all fairly early. But I left the first half of that series feeling like in a different timeline, or if I was a little older, I would have been a huge Isaiah Thomas stan, because he, partially because I'm an Eagles and I grew up as like a Flyers fan, and like mean teams that fight, teams that like throw their elbows, like, got me as a kid. But I left feeling like, hey, if Thomas had won as much as Jordan, we would be saying the opposite shit. Maybe another way of saying this is, what makes Isaiah Thomas's run and makes that whole team's run, you know, dirty, the elbow shots, the attitude, all that stuff disappears and gets hagiography if they go on to win as many, if they go on to three-peat, right? If they go on to you know, do 2 3-peats in a row. They get the treatment that Jordan's bullying during practice gets. They get the treatment that the weird backroom stuff gets here. It's like, oh, yeah, it's unavoidable. But really, it was just this one guy. You know, it is what it is. And I think you feel that the most with Rodman's character, because Rodman bridges that gap between those two teams. And suddenly, the traits that made Rodman a part of this dirty team that pulled no punches and had an attitude and walked away from the court without saying goodbye becomes quirky and even useful. He's just such a good defender. He just gets in people's faces. He just gets the ball no matter what it costs. And yeah, he needs to go to Vegas overnight in the middle of an important series.
But be gone for 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's just who Rodman is. You know?
Even at the time, like, it sort of registered as, like, this is weird. It was, like, tribalism in action. Chicago hated Dennis Rodman. Like,
right.
Dennis Rodman's game was infuriating to watch. If he was not your player, he was an infuriating dude. And that's even setting aside the fact that, like, oh, you know, Dennis Rodman is weird. He's transgressive in ways that, like, very straight-laced 90s America really rejected and judged very harshly, right? Like,
And that doc did not. That's what, like, a Rodman doc would have been more fascinating to dig into. Is he is such a interesting cultural figure for holding up a mirror to, like, 90s cultural values in a way that the Jordan series just barely. I mean, I remember so much of that, like, you know, people talking about, oh, why, you know, Rodman would, like, walk around in a wedding dress just to do it. Or I think when he got married, he wore a wedding dress. I want to say is the story, but just a really fascinating guy. And then now he goes to North Korea.
Well, yeah. And yeah, like, look, they ain't all.
Is that his wizards?
The bits ain't all going, like, to be,
you
winners.
Know, on one hand, playing just a little too long. On the other hand, you know, going to fascist regimes and, you know, palling around, you know, we all have our issues as we enter our old age.
I think, but it was just so funny to me to see the way, like, Chicago rallied around Dennis Rodman once he became a Bull. It was so funny the way, like, oh, man, he's so great. Really just have to appreciate the craft of his game. And, like,
look, Rob, if Aaron Rodgers said, I'm leaving the Packers and coming to the Bears, leave it all behind, my friend. You come. I will root for you happily.
Are there any other thoughts here on The Last Dance? Are there any other shows you want to shout out there or media that you've been consuming in this particular moment of crisis and existential dread?
I'll say that I lean fully in. Like, give me those bad vibes. Like, just...
Okay.
Just, we're in Hell World. I want to spend all my time in Hell World, pretty much. That and the occasional detour to escapism, but, like, you know, a series that I found new resonance with. in the midst of all this is Counterpart, which is a world where there's two parallel realities, one of which is like what prior to this we would have recognized as our world, where everything is normal and neoliberal and, you know, kind of vaguely shitty and corrupt, but like normal, as we would call it. And then the other world is a world where life has never gone back to normal because of a plague. And it's about how those two realities diverged. And I'm like, yes, I love this show now. This show rules. Give me more of this. Worth checking out. I think it's on Amazon. But yeah, that's my mode. Like the first thing I did when this all started was, I'm going to play Vampyr again. That was a good decision.
I am with Rob. I'd like to revel in. You know, yeah, I was the first person to watch, you know, the outbreak and other pandemic films. The moment this happened, I was like, cool. Let's just really just
that soak naughty monkey
in this. Yeah, but that movie is so fucking bad. I like highly recommend watching it, but it's so fucking bad. We just watched, my wife and I just blew through Hulu's The Great, which is written by the screenwriter that did The Favorite from a year or two back.
I love The Favorite.
So imagine that spun out to a whole series and is about sort of the rise of Catherine the Great in Russia. It's tremendous. I forget the actor. Who is the guy?
He was Cyclops in those movies, wasn't he?
Yeah. What is Nicholas Holt? He makes, as someone pointed out, some incredible acting choices in this show that when I mentioned I'd watched it, someone on Twitter put it perfectly, which is like he makes some very Nicolas Cagean choices in how he chooses to portray his character. And yeah, it's really a delight. If you liked The Favorite at all, this The Great is a lot of fun. Yeah, recommended.
Awesome. Kata, what are you getting to?
It's mostly the same stuff, just a lot of it.
Like, oh, sure.
I just feel like I've been burning through a lot of backlog in the anime area specifically. Just feels like there's more time to...
He drills like through.
This, there's like this little, like I kind of felt called out by even asking him, Kato, what are you watching? He's like,
specifically.
People want to know what anime you're watching, Kato.
I'm watching Gundam Wing. Shout outs to the Great Gundam Project. I'm following along with them on their watch of that, and I'm enjoying it a lot more than I ever had before, which is great.
It's good. Yeah, it turns out it's fucking real.
Turns out it's great. I have issues with the dub that I feel like I had trouble reading that series the way that I'm reading it now because I think the dub is bad. But anyways.
Yeah, the dub. Yes. The dub is very strange.
Yeah.
I love the dub, but that's because I grew up with it, and it's like
that's part of why I bounced off as a kid was like that I could not parse the dub. I was like too small for that to understand the pacing of that with the dub. Anyways, and actually a bunch of Netflix anime, like Netflix suddenly has like a lot of good original anime shows that it's putting out. I'm watching Dorohedoro right now, which is really fucking good. Like I love. And they're doing this interesting thing with the animation where it's all like it's 3D models, but they've got this really great filter on that makes it look really similar. Like they've approximated the look of the manga really well, even though it's 3D models, which is interesting. But yeah, just like burning through. What else did I watch? I watched Beastars. I watched what else? I finished something else recently. I can't forget. I'm watching so many of them like back to back to back. All short shows, it turns out.
Short shows are good. Things you can complete, I think, are high like on my list of things here. Actually, that's not true at all. The things that I'm doing is bouncing between a bunch of things. I'm in, like, taste mode. I'm like, I have wanted to revisit Witch Hunter Robin. I have wanted to go back and rewatch the same episodes of What We Do in the Shadows that I've watched already once.
Oh, season two.
Season two is great. Yeah, I have to rewatch season one before I get season two. Like, this is who I am. And I have literally just been bouncing from thing to thing and getting, like, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And that's not always fulfilling, but it's actually like, it's because I feel like I have a lot of time to watch stuff that I can move through seven things slowly instead of feeling like I need to like consume all of a thing at once. Like I've been watching, Rob and I have talked about this before, watching Clone Wars lately. It's like I've taken like a 3-week break from Clone Wars, but I'm not done with Clone Wars. I'm going to come back into it in a week. You know, like
it's, you hear it's, that, Clone Wars?
I'm coming for not you, done with Wars. You. You've been good. I'm coming back.
Clone Wars is just off somewhere trying to live its life, start a family, knock, knock, knock.
Here's Michael Jordan. I got a problem with Clone Wars.
God. What was the... I can't believe I've forgotten the phrasing that Jordan always used in it. It's going to kill me. It's fine. I'm looking
at the last thing I would shout out, the other thing I've been really into lately is a podcast called KingCast, which is run by two great hosts. Scott Wampler is the guy I know. I don't know the other host by name, but basically they're going through a bunch of Stephen King adaptations in which they read the book and watch the movie and then invite a guest. The guest gets to pick like the adaptation. And so they've done lots of just the weird stuff that you wouldn't normally think if you made like a list of like Stephen King adaptations, like The Lawnmower Man. I did not know that Stephen King sued to get his name take off The Lawnmower Man because New Line just had the rights and just slapped The Lawnmower Man on it, even though it has nothing to do with the short story that Stephen King wrote. It's just a really fascinating series if you're interested and grew up with King like I did, and they have a lot of really cool guests like Elijah Wood and some other folks, so I've been really enjoying listening to that.
The phrase I was thinking of was, it became personal to me, which is something Michael Jordan said a lot. But
Anakin
I do want
Skywalker
to...
interviewed years later.
And then it became personal to me.
God. Also, speaking of Stephen King podcast, can I pitch a not yet started but about to start alternate King podcast, because it's friends of the site.
Sure.
Cameron Kunzelman and Michael Lutz, who do Game Study Study Buddies and who guested on one of our Kingdom Hearts. Wow, why have I forgotten the
lore
name?
Lore reasons.
I'm tired. I said it's tired. That's how tired I am. are starting a podcast called Just King Things, which is a great name for a Stephen King podcast, where they're going to read every Stephen King thing in publication order and talk about it. It will probably take them about a decade. That is like what the timeline looks like to do that, because it turns out Stephen King's written a lot of stuff. If you've listened to Game Study Study Buddies, you know that that they're great podcast hosts and have incredible conversations and are very good at getting sidetracked with setup in a way that I think if you like this podcast, you'll understand and enjoy. So
Stephen King, one of the many great facts I've learned over listening to the KingCast is that he gave up smoke. He had a lot of substance abuse issues, wrote a lot of his great works while like using a lot of coke and coming to grips with his alcoholism. But one of the things, he eventually also gave up smoking, but apparently every night, there's just this unsaid thing where, like, after dinner, he goes for a car ride, smokes a pack of cigarettes, but he doesn't smoke, and just nobody talks about it. That's just what he does. He's not a smoker. It's just at the end of the night, he goes out, smokes a pack of cigarettes, and comes home, and just nobody acknowledges.
So he smokes.
He's a pack a day smoker.
Yeah, what you're telling me is he's a pack.
But
he
it's
goes
contained.
Out on a drive.
Smoking.
In fact, I bet it's worse if you just go out and straight smoke a pack, not the pack a day. It's like on average a pack a day.
I forget the specifics, but it's something like that where it's just like he's like, hey, this is it. I'm gonna this one window I smoke and then I don't smoke. So I guess you can that's the whatever lies we tell ourselves.
I just look forward to all the people who are gonna stumble on these podcasts because they're looking for like a men's culture podcast. Oh, the KingCast. That sounds great.
Just King Rose
picking each other up.
Yo,
oh, you drop
how do
this,
I pick
homie?
Up chicks?
What is the Stephen King story most about being bros?
I don't know the Uber.
This is a real question.
Nearly well enough.
No, yeah, Patrick, me either, clearly.
What's the
deferring
bro-iest
to Patrick.
Being a bro? I don't know. I'd have to think about that.
Like, right, subtext well, is guys being dudes.
That's his, I mean, that's
not really his, not really his thing, usually.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Let's move on to another question.
Question two of our deep dive into the question bucket.
We knew what the fuck it was. This one, this one's a little lighter. This one comes in from Andrew, who says, what do y'all think about Star Wars Squadrons? I haven't heard anything about your thoughts on it. We didn't do a post-EA episode.
That's right.
Because that I mean, that event, woof, that event just didn't have too much going on. And I don't think it's worth, like, dragging that whole event necessarily. But I thought Squadrons looked pretty good. My guess is that story mode is going to be, that campaign is going to be pretty short. It's a $40 game.
I'm worried that it's going to be Battlefront-esque in that it's a tease for a game that you like wish they made.
I think that that is true. That is my gut. I would believe that. And I'm still at $40, I'll buy it and fly around.
I feel like the $40 should be the tip of the hat, which is like, that's them sort of, you know,
this is
like, keep your expectations.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Low, you know, probably a 4 to 5 hour campaign is probably what you're looking at there.
Rob, what'd you think of that thing?
I mean, I hope it's good. I'm curious. I really want the campaign to be solid. That's like, there is some sort of story content there. I hope it's good. Yeah. But it also,
what is a solid campaign for you? Is it like 10 hours? Is it like
no,
lots
not do the
of fiddly
thing.
Bits?
Is it
well, that's, I'm giving you a couple of different things. This is what I'm trying to say. Is it having like control over what type of craft you're using? Is it like what makes it a solid campaign for you?
You know those arcs in the Clone Wars where you and I are messaging each other where it's like, oh man, the entire Geonosis stuff. Did you see that shit? Or
basically
there's a type of military sci-fi that is cool as hell and also deeply procedural, right? Where like part of the drama is also seeing people tackle difficult challenges and employ tools and also the strengths of their teams in really interesting and exciting ways. And to me, a cool campaign would have some sort of feeling like that, right? Where it's not completely discrete missions that don't really tie together. It's like, okay, this is the mission where we meet the, you know, weird, wacky, secret TIE fighter project. You know,
it's
going to be more stuff like...
This was just supposed to be a normal patrol mission. And then we scanned this this Imperial, you know, frigate, and there was some weird contraband on it, and it was revealed to have been taken over by rebels and blah, 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 blah. It's classic TIE fighter shit.
Yeah, and to me, that's kind of what I want. Like, you don't need to tell a hugely involved story. Like, I think about the original TIE Fighter game. There is a traitorous Imperial Admiral who is a background figure in a couple campaigns when you're just doing boring space cop shit for the Empire. And then in, I think it's the last campaign of what was originally in the box, in the TIE Fighter box, the guy turns traitor and basically tries to have you killed mid-mission. And then there's an entire campaign, like 10 missions, just of the Empire trying to corral this guy, pin him down, trap his fleet, eliminate his ability to escape, and kill him. And each mission sets up the next part of that puzzle, and it gets increasingly like hairy as the guy becomes desperate and cornered. And that's kind of what I'm looking for in a game. Like, give me that, but also some characters to go with it. Like, the weakness of TIE Fighter is basically you're just a random TIE Fighter, but you're also the most important person in all the missions. There's no people in that story for the most part. Mm-hmm. Give me a little bit of that Aaron Alston Wraith Squadron stuff, where, like, there is a team, there are team dynamics, there are politics surrounding it. That's the shit. And you can do that. That can be a long campaign, or it can be a very short one, but it just needs to be a good, satisfying story.
Yeah, I'm in. The pitch you just made, that's a pitch I'm curious about. I would hope that they pull that off. We'll see.
Hold up.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's one from Waz, who says, best donut flavor? I will eat a custard-filled donut any day, any time.
Mm. Don't like anything in the donut. Donut's got to be donut? Oh, you full. Want, I just want that dough.
You don't want a cream or a jelly
alone.
Or a...
No. Can't
so
do
what
it.
What flavor of a donut, then? Are you like a chocolate... chocolate person?
I am a pretty big, like, yeah, I lived in San Francisco at what felt like the beginning of the height of the hipster donut, which now is everywhere. Yeah. It was around I was living in San Francisco at the same time where it felt like everything had bacon on it for no particular reason. Also, that like put me off bacon for a long time. I was just like, you know what? I like bacon, but fuck bacon right now because I was just annoyed seeing it everywhere. Because I don't eat donuts all that often. So it's like when I have one, like just a really good chocolate donut, maybe I'll go like a little adjacent to like a strawberry. I had one this morning.
A strawberry frosted. I don't know how quickly frosting. We went from, I don't have donuts that much to, well, this morning.
Well,
what happened was.
Normally when I'm dropping my daughter off at my mom, she goes there a couple days a week to give us a little bit of a break for since we started working again. And usually I just get her a donut. I'm like, you're gonna have a donut. This is like a special thing you get on the way to your grandma's house. And then today she's like, you know what? You and mama should have a donut too. And I was like, I'm good. Like, you know, dad has enough beer. He doesn't need other, he doesn't eat candy for a reason. Like that's, and he's like, no, I need you to get a donut for you and mama. I was like, all right, twist my arm. I'll get this goddamn donut. And I had to get a strawberry donut because that's what she decided. But it was a pretty good, Dunkin' Donuts are fine. They're fine. They're good.
That, like, again, as someone who lived in New York during that same period, that same, like, donut factory, like, fancy donut period, those donuts are good. I like those donuts. But sometimes I just want, like, a Dunkin' Donuts-ass donut with a Dunkin' Donuts-ass coffee that's just, like, yeah, this is, like, if there could be such a thing just called coffee water, it would be Dunkin' Donuts coffee.
Which is what I'm drinking right now. I'm drinking a Dunkin' Donuts coffee.
I don't mind it. I'll fuck me up.
It's fine. It gets the job done, you know?
It gets the job done.
It's burnt to hell.
Yep.
It doesn't have much flavor, but boy, it goes in your body.
In terms of donut flavor, my taste has changed a lot over the years. I used to be like a diehard Boston cream fan. That's like what my stepdad loved. It was what my mom loved. Like my parents before me, I was a Boston cream guy. but I've slowly become like it's just too much for me now. It is like I like the cream a lot, and so I'll still have one a few times a year. You know what I mean? But if I went to a Dunkin' Donuts right now, I would probably get a glazed donut and a strawberry frosted donut, or some like that's the space I'm in now. Lighter, fluffier, not as like heavy.
The cake variant is usually when you get like the heavier.
Yeah, I don't like the dough. What I won't have is like a chocolate donut where it's like chocolate.
Rob's
all the way
eyes just went.
It's too much for me. I like it. There are if I'm going to a fancy donut place, that's where I'll get a cake donut. Right.
That makes
I don't
sense.
Do
yes.
that very often anymore. Rob has thoughts about this. Rob, weigh in.
Yeah, I think. Oh boy.
<Ooh. laughs> All right, here we go.
So Rob's got notes.
What I'll say is the cake donut, I think, is generally my preferred type of donut. I think it's, first of all, it's the one that feels more like a food, plausibly.
No, none of it's food. None of it's food,
but there's a little bit of substance. There's like a chew to a cake donut as opposed to the yeast donut, which I do like, but they're so ridiculous. And I think...
They're cotton candy, but good.
Krispy Kreme
That's what
thing?
They are.
Hell yes. Yeah. There you go.
That's what I want. Anyway, sorry. You get Christmas what? Go ahead.
Yeah, I got swept up in the Krispy Kreme thing, and I think that ruined me for yeast donuts forever.
Oh,
because
sure.
It was like eating
dude.
Crystallized sugar were a donut that was
too much.
Krispy Kreme.
Yeah.
And everyone convinced, it was like this mass delusion where everyone is like, Krispy Kreme's the best. Oh man, is the light on? The Krispy Kremes are fresh. And everyone's like, hell yeah, let's get those Krispy Kremes.
Oh my God.
And then there was this point where I was like, this is vastly inferior to Dunkin' Donuts. Like, now Dunkin' Donuts then got worse because they stopped baking fresh on site.
Yeah, the shipped in Dunkin' Donuts, not as good. Not as good as like, yeah. Like their whole fucking thing, their whole thing for years was that they were made on site. That was like, was the
donut
ad campaign.
Man was a good, hardworking man who just wanted to give you good donuts.
I know.
If you didn't want good donuts, Entenmann's was right there.
Right.
Also, really good bad donuts.
They're great bad donuts. Entenmann's. Those are the cake donuts I'll eat.
Just you gotta eat the little chocolate shell off the styrofoam.
Actually, well, I'll do the powdered ones. I won't do the chocolate ones. I can't deal with the chocolate. The Entenmann's chocolate stuff is just so. Well, I've never liked it, even when I had a sweeter tooth as a kid. Anyway, continue.
So here's what I've not outgrown though.
Yeah,
Dunkin' Donuts used to make this donut really well. They don't anymore because it really does require being reasonably fresh. But at places that are like Dunkin' Donuts used to be, in my area, neck of the woods, we have Heavenly Donuts. Which is real good. And the chocolate cream filled is just delicious. It's absurd. It is probably a little disgusting, but the chocolate cream is so creamy and delicious.
A chocolate cream is too much for me. I'm not a chocolate person. I feel like I mix it in my life. Like, you know, you could drizzle some chocolate on my life, but I can't have it as like, I don't want to get a chocolate something. I won't mind it if there's chocolate involved in the thing. I'm just... Anyway, thank you, Waz. I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to come back to Waz for some other questions. Waz sent in a brick of questions, and they were all very good, which is
like
not
a cake.
Like a cake. Here's a question. At what point does a bread become a cake?
I don't. Rob?
At what point does a bread become a cake?
I feel like this has something to do with the gluten structure.
It does. Like, there's the first thing is
it's less gluten.
Did you let it rise or not? Yeah.
If no, then...
Yeah, so, like, did you develop, like, long gluten strands and, like, do a rise? If you did, then you've probably made something like a bread. If you just sort of mixed everything together and baked that shit, probably closer to the cake, you know, end of the spectrum. It also depends what your leavening agent is. You know, there's... I don't want to say there's no such thing as a yeasted cake, but, like... Cakes aren't yeasted. Like that's just not what it is. Like the minute like baking powder and baking soda are your primary leaveners, again, you're in cake territory. And then how sweet is that shit?
Is a biscuit a cake? Fair.
Is what?
Is a what a cake?
A biscuit.
Is a biscuit a cake?
Yes.
Okay.
It's more a cake than a bread.
Well, in my mind wants to say bread because usually you put like
our
butter
use
on
cases.
It. And like,
yeah, but
I mean,
that's just
like
some
but
people.
It, but it like fits in them. Pancake, like it fits in that family.
Right, totally.
That's exactly right. And don't trick yourself. A pancake is a cake. You're having a cake when you have pancakes. 100%. All right, let's swing back the other direction. This one's from Zenith in San Francisco, who says, despite the bleak mood of the moment, which in this case is actually this particular moment, in order to be part of the conversation, I played through The Last of Us Part 1 and Left Behind DLC in preparation for the sequel. In 2013, the phrase Black Lives Matter would never have occurred to me. It would have seemed like a given, but experiencing the story in 2020 with those words etched in my heart, well, I wanted to dig into the philosophical questions behind Joel's choice and whether or not I thought Ellie believed him, but the only thing I could think about afterwards was that there were four black characters of note in that story. The first succumbs to infection and is shot to death by the second. The second shoots himself in the head rather than live without the first. The third is shot to death by Joel to prevent her from pursuing Ellie. And the fourth, in a prequel, gets infected and does not have immunity. None of these read to me as token characters, and yet all of them are killed in the name of narrative drama. As a white male developer, like the overwhelmingly majority of employees at Naughty Dog... I don't think this person is saying that they are a developer at Naughty Dog. They're saying, as a white guy, I cannot help but feel like I am part of the problem. It's getting harder and harder in this industry. But that isn't a question. So how upset am I reasonably allowed to get if no characters of color survive the events of Last of Us Part 2? And thank you for letting me vent. I realized that, like, this was something that bugged me a lot about Last of Us 1, and then I didn't bring it up in our Last of Us 2 conversation because I had not revisited Last of Us 1. But I'm curious, as both of you have now finished the game, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I finished it last night.
Hey, are there any black folks in that game?
Well,
Patrick and I were discussing this very issue last night after he finished.
Yeah, there are.
We don't have to get into spoilers, but do you feel like those characters were developed? Do you feel like those characters
were? Are they all characters? That's your first question.
Yeah.
One of them is a character. One of them is just a very big, burly threat
that
you have to viciously kill.
And mutilate their face.
Cool.
Good. Last of Us Part 2, you know, is a more diverse, like, cast of characters overall. But, like, this person's question is speaking specifically to, you know, the presence and characterization of the black characters. And this is, like, very specifically noteworthy in, you know, you can argue all over the place over the Last of Us thriller or horror, but the horror genre in general has, like, a long, fraught history with the presence of how they deploy black characters. There's a reason the trope of, you know, the black guy's going to die exists, is because they are often just used as violent fodder, even ahead of the white violent fodder that often makes up a lot of horror. And so, you know, is Last of Us 1 or 2, like, particularly egregious on that count? Like, I think the first game, like, definitely could have been more mindful of that, and the second one probably could be as well. It tries to, you know, I guess, quote unquote, make up for it in other areas, but it's, I don't know. I don't know that it is necessarily as conscious of the history of black people in horror situations as it could be. And again, like, when I pointed out one specific late game encounter to Rob, his, like, we weren't on a video call, but his eyes went the equivalent of wide as I, like, recounted it, because I had just gone through to my playthrough.
Yeah. So I'd forgotten the guy you have to fight. I think the other part of the black guy always dies thing, I remember that trope a lot from war movies, and I think a lot of that also stems from the fact the presumed perspective was white. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times black characters died because they had to make a noble sacrifice. That was the war movie move. Like, if you go back and watch movies made during World War II and immediately after, the version of not racial reconciliation, not equality, just something much milder, which is that, like, black people are people too, but also they are your friends, and they recognize their place, which is to serve you.
Yeah, it's like a sublimation of attention is what it is, right? Like, it's like, you know, we know that there's a situation at hand, but in this moment, here's how we are going to, like, snap that tension taut so that it can be useful to us instead of letting it knot up and get in the way.
But I think the other issue with, so, just the media landscape in games is going to make a game like Last of Us come under extra scrutiny, because when representation is bad across the board, these major projects don't get to say, well, lots of games are doing this. Like, this is just what our game is about. Like, not representing different perspectives is a choice, or it is at least a failure to improve the landscape or the discourse. But I think The Last of Us in particular, the dread and anxieties of The Last of Us have, to me, always been very white, middle class centered. And a lot of that game, both its visions of horror and its visions of hope, are extremely white American. And I think that makes it very easy for the game to sort of stumble into this thing where it's like Jackson in The Last of Us 2, the huge idyllic survival community. Mm-hmm. There are black characters in the background of those scenes, I'm pretty sure, but blackness doesn't exist in that space, because the moment you introduce it, it changes the space. Yeah. They just want Jackson, Wyoming to be a good Western frontier town where everyone's pitching in together and pulling in the same direction, and they all live in beautiful houses with white picket fences, and they've got, you know, their borders closed to the outside world. And if you say, okay, but a bunch of our main characters here, the people who you're going to be observing Jackson through their eyes, they're black. Immediately,
yeah.
Jackson either has to change and address the fact that, like, why don't these tensions that we know exist in our world exist in Jackson? And that has to be confronted in some way.
Right.
Or Jackson has to be a complicated place in the way that the world is a complicated place. And you might not feel good about how one of your heroes or how one of your main characters has to navigate around your other heroes and your other sympathetic characters and sort of be trapped in their version of what an idyllic society is, even if it really doesn't answer their needs or speak to what they would prefer to see. Last of Us just sidesteps that and is like, you know what would be great is if we could all just live in our freeholds, you know, behind walls topped with razor wires, and we all go out on patrol together. And
it tips it to one degree, right? Where, like, you know, there's the one guy, the one bigot in Jackson that they choose to highlight who, like, has a problem with two girls kissing. But that's, like, the most you get in terms of, like, scratching at, like, what would be any sort of conflict between people other than just, well, the infected are bad.
Right. Yeah, well, that all adds up to me. I know y'all are going to do your Last of Us spoiler cast next week. Also, Rob, you have a piece up on the site now for folks who want to know your deepest thoughts on the way that game ends. Do you have a way of pitching us that piece?
Yeah, so I think one of the funny arcs, and I think we even experienced a little bit of it here, was that people would start playing this game and be like, Rob, I just don't, you know, I get your view is your view, but, like, I love it. This is great. And I'm like, my response was always, just keep going. Just see what other treats this game has in store for you. Because for me, the place I was about 6 hours before the game ended, very different than the place I was by the time the credits rolled. And in that, like, it was such a botched ending that it didn't just say, okay, it has third act problems. The way it screws up its ending goes back and recasts basically, like, several key choices or implied choices throughout the game and kind of make you wonder, like, what has any of this been about? Like, why is the story about Ellie? What, like, what was the point of telling this story from Ellie's perspective at all if this is what they were going to do? But to get into all of that, you have to talk through the denouement of The Last of Us. So that's my piece explaining sort of how the end, like, The Last of Us relies on endgame reveals that if you have any sort of ability to read between the lines at the very heavy subtext early in the game, it reveals stuff you already knew. And so if you were looking for, like, okay, but what's the deeper answer? What's the real thing driving these characters? The Last of Us doesn't have an answer. The obvious shit is the things that game thinks are good.
Give it a read. It's a good piece. People should, especially as folks play through and finish the game. I feel like Rob's perspective on not just, like, the events here and what sits right versus what doesn't, but kind of the political subtext, the underlying through lines, the ideological through lines there is really strong. So go read that piece.
There was a point as I was just before I was finishing it where I was like, Rob, what if I just turned the game off right here? It's fine. We're good. He's like, no. You need to see the final 3 hours.
No. And I said, okay. Oh, God. This is also a moment really quick to we could talk briefly about that Polygon story and the Naughty Dog stuff. I know, Patrick, you had some thoughts there. Do you want to summarize that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, the events that occurred happened just before I came back from my leave. But Rob reviewed The Last of Us Part 2 for us. And there's been the piece of Polygon is essentially over, like, this tension that has been playing out between critics, fans. There's just, like, this game is being pulled at out a lot of threads in a lot of ways that has caused, I think everyone expected that this game was going to cause a certain amount of consternation. And it was just sort of, like, primed to be kind of like a bomb that went off, regardless of how you felt about it, liked it or didn't like it. And anyway, like our contribution to the Polygon piece was just Rob confirming that, you know, his review of the game was pretty down on it in general. I think it was a very, I think he lays out his feelings on it very concisely and very elaborately. You know how he feels and why he feels. As a result of that, Rob had to, I mean, Rob can speak to the specifics of what occurred next, but we, you know, we fielded a call from Sony's public relations department to explain the review, talk through the review a bit. I guess, Rob, you can sort of contextualize how you felt about that call specifically.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was not... So for me, Patricia Hernandez over at Polygon reached out asking about various things she'd heard about just slightly weird interactions people may have had with Sony PR around The Last of Us. And my suspicion is that this was also coming from other corners, like that there were other people sharing some stories. That
if you're being asked, the reason you're being asked is because you're hearing whispers about other things.
Yeah. And so I had something unusual happen, which is that the day that review went up, somebody from Sony PR reached out and was like, hey, we think some of these parts of your review just are unfair. And like my position was like basically the gist of it was you don't seem to give the game credit for some of the meaningful improvements it makes over The Last of Us 1, like graphics and like enemy AI. And my position was like, and I was happy to write back and just explain like, the graphics look better, but does the game look better? Right? Like, does the texture resolution, does the lighting, does that change? Does that move the needle? It doesn't for me. Maybe it does for other people, but they have their review. I have mine. As for like enemy AI, again, I felt encounter design was just repetitive enough that the improvements to AI or enemy behavior didn't really register as hugely significant. But, like, that was no problem, and that was about it. Like, it was just kind of a, hey, you kind of dismissed some of the work we did. What's up with that? And my response was, I didn't dismiss it. I just don't think the improvements were quite as solid as y'all thought. But congratulations. Like, you have a hit on your hands. Let me know if you want to talk more. And they were pretty chill. They were like, yeah, we disagree, but it is subjective. So have a good one. And that was it. But I think some of the thing that probably drove that piece is like some Naughty Dog. Neil Druckmann needs to be on Twitter less.
Yeah,
just needs bro. Like that's the thing. Like this came on the heels of a weekend where Neil Druckmann appeared to be beefing with some people who were talking about his work. And that was a little bit strange. And I think that was probably what was driving it. Obviously, the example Patricia really gets into is the bizarre, like, simmering feud between him and Jason Schreier that played out over Twitter. That really embarrassing Troy Baker, the man in the arena thing. Like, there's just
you have
there
to
was
set
some
that up.
Corny
you
shit
can't just
happening.
Say the Troy Baker man in the arena thing.
Yeah, there was just some corny shit happening around this, and I think that prompted a piece just sort of asking, like, hey, has there been other sort of weird or defensive response that stands out? I will say one of the things that also jumped out, Alex Navarro was on Twitter saying that, you know, this is pretty normal from the perspective of those of us who were working in this industry like 15, 20 years ago.
Wow. He also specifically said, I would paraphrase, like, wow, not enough of my colleagues have gotten these calls because they haven't written enough reviews that go off the general consensus, which, you know, is part of Alex being in the industry long enough to have done it enough times. Also, I think, in some ways is a noteworthy and correct critique that often reviews tend to be like roughly the same in general, at least on the first wave of outlets that review a title. But yeah, these aren't like if you've done this for 20 years, you've maybe not you personally, but your editor has fielded a handful of these calls. Like,
oh, yeah.
They happen. They still happen. They happened before. They were a little more heavy handed in the past because there would be explicit threats that went alongside that in regards to like pulling ads, which that part doesn't really happen these days because video games don't advertise as much. Advertising has changed.
I feel like some of the politics around that really did change after what we now call Gerstmann-gate, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think the Kane and Lynch thing blew up in such a toxic way that I think after that, and that's roughly where I came in, right? Like, I started working in this field about a year after all of that happened. But I think specifically, that's when I started listening to 1UP, because I was like, this story seems fucked up, and I need to learn more about it, and that's how I stumbled into 1UP and all that shit, and here I am. But that was such a weird and notable story at the time that I think prior to that, probably those sort of heavy-handed tactics were maybe a little bit more common, but
I had alluded to on Twitter because I couldn't remember the specifics of this story, and some of this I'm still gonna get wrong, so apologies to history, I suppose. But like when I worked at 1UP, when I was the news editor there for less than a year before I went to MTV, but there was an instance in which the dynamics at 1UP were so fascinating because what would happen often is that, you know, EGM would get games, you know, 2-3 months in advance because they had to review them and put it to print before those magazines went out. So like they were getting access to games like so early relative to what happens now where you get it, you know, 2 or 3 weeks before a game goes live. And EGM, what would happen is that EGM would get access to the games and then we would pick and choose, or the reviews staff would pick and choose EGM reviews to become the 1UP review, because then a new person didn't have to review that game. That could just go up as the 1UP review alongside whenever the reviews for online could happen. But what would it, because the magazine stuff was known so early, it also meant that publishers knew well in advance like what the scores of their games were going to be. And so there was a specific instance in which EGM really didn't like the first Assassin's Creed. I believe the scores were something. I was trying to familiarize myself with it, but the scores were given like the lowest one was a 4 out of 10. It was like a 4, like a 5.5, and like a 6.5. So it was a pretty low on that game, especially the four was even an outlier for even folks that had rightful criticism of that first game. And basically, like Ubisoft like threw a shit fit over it. They threatened to pull a bunch of advertising, I believe then said that, well, actually, 1UP is not allowed to publish. You cannot use this EGM review as the 1UP review. You are not allowed to like use that as part of like the online embargo. Like the way that it was settled was that like EGM then chose like the high, like they picked the highest review, like the highest score. It was like, okay, that'll be the one that becomes the 1UP review as like a compromise with Ubisoft. And Ubisoft's like selectively allowed outlets to like hit their different embargoes or go early on an embargo based on inside information they had because of this dynamic of magazines and online websites. And I tried to write an article about that, and then Ziff management killed it because once I'd started asking questions, they were already the understanding was that it was going to cost a lot of money for the company. And so they eventually sort of like killed the story, and was one of the reasons that I ended up like leaving that place. But like that was like that stuff, as far as I know, that stuff really doesn't happen as much because that financial tie is less there. Not that heavy-handed things don't occur. I know someone was sharing a story out of all this about, you know, some pressure they'd heard from Square Enix about a Final Fantasy review, and we've heard murmurings of other stuff that have occurred. Yeah, so it still exists.
There's still stuff out there in terms of in terms of publishers trying to direct the way coverage goes. It's probably the broadest and safest way I can say it. There are stories that are not my stories to tell, but they're out there still. But it's not you don't hear the advertising dollar stuff as much because so much of the industry has gotten away from endemic advertising, thankfully, and because I think that like partly we've managed to reconfigure the industry such that to even breach that, we now have platforms on which we could drag them for it, and it would cost them more money.
That kind of story would get out. Right.
That's exactly
like,
it. If there was a financial threat.
Right. But something like this where, you know, on some level, you know, someone like Rob and I brushes off the Sony conversation because, well, it doesn't materially change anything that we're going to do. But also we're used to it, having done this for a long enough time. But it's also worth acknowledging that even as like we know that anyone we work with, we've done this long enough, it's like, whatever. That's just one of those like small costs of doing business. Like they still sent us code for Ghost of Tsushima. You know what I mean? Like, right. this all happened after that.
But to be clear, like, the one...
But especially for, like... Or I guess finish your thought.
Yeah, the thing is, I'll say is, like, it's not like that hasn't happened the other way before, right? Which was
right.
because of our coverage of Detroit Become Human before Detroit Become Human came out, we didn't get code for that. They like, dragged me on a month-long... We just have to get on the phone and knock this thing out. I talked to someone in person at a Judges Week event and then finally got on the phone with someone. And like the result was like, yeah, it's not going to work out this time, Austin. Sorry. And because of that, like the specific instance why I think this is a great example of how this stuff is still important to kind of fight about sometimes, we didn't get to publish Yusef Cole's piece on that game and on its handling of race and its handling of kind of its civil rights narrative until 2 weeks after that game had come out, at which point that piece doesn't get a lot of eyeballs on it. Like, that's just it could have been the best piece Yusef's ever written. I don't think it was. Yusef's written incredible pieces. It's a strong piece, but it doesn't get the eyeballs on it that it deserves because the window for people caring about reading about Detroit has closed by at least a week, probably by 2 weeks, because it's like two weeks after the embargo wraps. And that's a piece that if we'd gotten that code ahead of time, he could have led that conversation. We could have had a black voice at the front of that conversation around that game, helping to shape what people thought of when they thought of that game and helping to shape the discourse around what it means to make a game about civil rights. And instead, that voice, his black voice, doesn't get to participate in the conversation when it's at its peak. And that stuff is not untargeted or that's not an accident. Do you know what I mean? They knew that we would probably put a writer on it who would be critical of the way it handled those issues. And it's not the only time. I've talked about the Call of Duty stuff after the Call of Duty preview. And that was an interesting and tricky one. I think speaks a little bit to some of the Last of Us stuff also. The Call of Duty preview last year after at E3 I published was really... or it was before E3, because it was announced before E3, was really skeptical and fairly negative of the ways in which that event promised, you know, thoughtful political intrigue and handling these issues in a new way for the series. And then was like, and these guns fucking sound dope. Like, you know, violence is going to be treated this very special way. And also, blah! And like that combination really set me off. But the thing that would have been really interesting in that preview to get into would have been, and then I played the multiplayer and fucking loved the multiplayer. Let me wrestle with that. But I couldn't do that because the multiplayer segment was embargoed. And so part of that conversation with PR from Activision was like, Austin, we saw you have a good time. I was like, motherfucker, I couldn't write about the good time I was having. I had a bad time in the event.
Last of Us.
And I couldn't talk about the best parts of the game.
This is what I'm talking about, Rob. This is why I bring this up, because it loops in that exact way. And those embargoes are often meant to encourage you to only be able to talk about the stuff that they think that you'll like, and yet there are times at which it means that the writing ends up being worse or less comprehensive in some ways. Patrick, you were going to say something else here.
Well,
too.
The last thing I wanted to say was that even having been in this this job long enough to brush that stuff off, the reason it's worth pointing out that it happens but is uncommon is that especially if you are a smaller outlet, if you don't know that this happens before, and you like. It is still an application of some measure of power by even having the conversation. And so discussing that it occurs, trying to wrestle with why that might be a problem, even if it doesn't materially impact anything that Vice does in terms of covering Sony or any other game going forward. It is worth disclosing that and discussing it and wrestling with that so that other places also can wrestle with that and know that when they have those conversations going forward. Yeah. Otherwise, you may be under the impression that like, oh, I guess this is just what we all do. We just sort of have to, I don't know. It's just worth acknowledging so that folks that are new.
Yeah, fucking push back on that shit. I do not have the time to go into it all. I mentioned it on the recent Branching Narratives podcast with Jeff Green. But there was a point at which Rockstar went back channel on us using some old connects to try to put pressure on us for being negative about not even being negative for raising the labor issue. And we got like an executive here at Vice trying to put pressure on us to try to keep us from reporting on the labor stuff or writing about it critically in any way. And I threw a fucking fit. Like that was the closest I was on vacation when it happened. Thank God. Otherwise I would have walked out. But when I came back, I had a very serious meeting with my boss. My boss was not part of the, my boss was great. My boss had done her best to shield us from this shit. But I basically said, if this ever happens again, we're done. And it has not happened again. I don't think that person will ever be in contact with us again in any meaningful regard. So if you're in a position where you are like surprised it's happening and it feels bad, make sure that you make that known, like fight for that independence. If you're in an editorial role at a site, if there's any sort of fuckery happening, you are in your rights to push back on that shit. And also, if you're a writer, you shouldn't be taking that call. An editor or a publisher ideally should be taking that call. No one on editorial should have to do that shit. I'm speaking quickly because I think y'all have a meeting to get to, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to wrap this one up. We only got through four questions of this Question Bucket Deep Dive. Classic Question Bucket Deep Dive. As always, you can send your questions to gaming at vice.com. I almost said idlethumbs.com. That's not true at all. It's because we're doing a Ruination Cast. Except we didn't have a timer. We should get a timer next time. We should do a timed Question Bucket episode.
Austin Walker, noted lover of podcast timers.
I love clocks.
When I brought that up, the amount of shit I got.
We did have
a really great discussion about this, but somebody put us on a clock.
That did happen. gamingadvice.com is the address. Make sure you use the subject question. Otherwise, I will not see it because we have a billion spam emails in there and I can't see them and it won't be caught up by the filter. I'm at Austin_Walker. You can follow us on twitter.com/waypoint. Go read Rob's piece in The Last of Us 2. Rob, where can people find you?
At Rob Zachney.
Patrick.
At Patrick Klubbock.
Kato.
Go read my Yoko Taro interview.
Go read Patrick's Yoko Taro interview. Kato.
We'll talk about it. At @A_Kato_ what was that?
I don't know. Appears on Twitter. You, as always, thank you to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. All right, everybody. I hope everyone has a safe and secure holiday weekend. Please be safe this weekend. I'm begging you all to be safe this weekend. And also, fuck capitalism. Go home.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
All right.
And maybe if you've got a glass jaw, the arena is not for you.
Maybe.
I meant to mention that it's also the name of Tom Brady's documentary series.
Oh, what is it?
Of course it is.
It's called The Man of the Arena. Of course it is.
So it was in my head and then I lost it and I'm so mad.
I can't believe Troy Baker is going to play Tom Brady in the inevitable Tom Brady video game. Adaptation.
Sucks when you got five rings,
dude,
a superhuman immune system, and yet you still got all those haters.
You got all those fucking haters bringing you down. Get the fuck out of here. Take the dub and move on. All right.
Bye.
Have a good one, y'all.
Bye. Bavarian cream.
So,
what are those?
They are genetically modified grapes.
Good.
To taste like cotton candy.
What?
And here's the thing. They do. They taste 100%
so you've had them.
Yeah, because they look like green grapes. They look like tiny green grapes.
You've purchased them accidentally.
Yes. So you're like, Jesus. Oh, tiny green grapes. Cool. Cotton candy grapes. That's probably like bullshit, right?
Like,
right,
yeah, like, just like a cutesy, yeah, oh, we need a brand. Delicious. Yeah. How do we stand out in the grape market?
Yeah. No, they taste exactly like cotton candy, but they're a grape. And it's fucked up. You're like, it's one of, if you're not prepared for it, it's one of the most horrifying bites you can.
Like, it's one thing to like sit down with a drink and forget that you got like you got iced tea instead of a soda or vice versa. We're like, oh, that's not the feeling I wanted in my mouth. It's
yeah, this entirely is like the classic vodka instead of water.
Vodka trick. Instead of water, right? Yeah, sure. But this is worse than that. At least with vodka, after I drink it, I'm like, oh, okay, wow, I'm a little buzzed. Cotton candy grapes would just ruin whatever meal I was trying to have or whatever snack I was trying. Because then you're left with like a bowl of grapes, right? And you're like, well, am I going to eat them? What am I supposed to do with these?
Oh yeah, these went straight into the trash. Like, because here's the thing, like. What a weird thing to do. Like, cotton candy sucks. Like, yes. It's okay, yeah, well, like it's bad. A cute. Kids enjoy it because it's fun. You have the whole machine go, yeah. But there's nothing to it. And, like, people eat a little bit and then they feel like shit. And they're like,
yeah, you want. Cotton candy is the, like, every 5 years you want someone else to make the dumbass decision to buy it. So you're like, can I have a piece? And you're like, yep. Good for 5 years, like that's what candy is. Yes.
So the notion that Sony was like, here's our idea,
right?
Like, grapes and cotton candy. Hun, did we figure out whether or not there it's a fully GMO thing or is it like soil treatment?
They bred that from existing grape.
Yeah. Okay. So it's bred. Like it's they are that is the grape. That is the essence of the grape.
I hate it.
So it's just super sweet. Part of what's confusing about this is the fact that, like, cotton candy, so much of the experience of cotton candy is it's got that specific texture, which I feel like is, like, half of the taste, honestly. Because it's just sugar.
It's a huge part of the mouth profile, right? Right. But it doesn't just taste like a spoonful of sugar, right? It does
not,
have a
not
different...
Not quite, yeah.
Yeah. It's been stretched and threaded. Weird.
I'm just trying to even imagine what a grape that tastes like that tastes like, feels like.
It's
now I want to get some.
We have the experience once. Yeah. Inoculate yourself against this version of cotton candy. Right? Like, it's like, you know, you go to a kid's birthday party. Yeah. You're like, give me a piece of that cotton candy. But also then you see like cotton candy grapes, buy some and be like, I must know. Then.
I'll go look. I'm going to look at the grocery store this week. I'm going to see if I can find some. I was going to say, let's do it at the next live show. And then I was like, well, who knows when that'll be. So I'll go look.
Just save it for a save point.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant. Yeah. bless you. All right.
It's so
time.
Dusty and
time that is. Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah, though. They do have Rainier cherries at the store. So... Life is
those
good.
Ones taste like a mountain.
Over 12 years, 100,000 plants were created and grown in test tubes for developing the cotton candy variety of grape. In 2010, IFG patented the grape and began licensing it to growers, including California grower Grapery.
Grapery.
I want pink. I want cotton candy wine.
What? What'd you say?
Make Rob, those
Rob,
cotton
so
candy
when Rob, when Rob says those grapes went straight in the trash, what he meant was he put them into a bucket and then began stepping on them with his feet so he could start the process of creating his cotton candy wine.
Yeah, uh-huh. I am curious about what that wine would be. Someone should do it.
It has to exist.
Someone has to have done it, right?
Yeah.
Probably not, because how recent are these things? Like... To do, you know what I mean? Like, it takes multiple generations of growth to produce viable, like, wine grapes. Now, I don't know if those rules apply to the miracle that is the cotton candy grape.
2010 is when it was licensed out. So, we're looking
someone
at a 10-year...
9 months ago is trying to make... is trying to do it. I don't see an update here.
They died.
Okay.
I have friends that say it's okay, not great, lol. Just being nice. Probably not worth trying again. I don't like it at all. I got absolutely
candy.
Zero.
Our popular cotton candy flavored wine is made with grapes from the Great Lakes growing region. This wine is slowly fermented to keep the natural cotton candy flavor of these grapes. Pairings. Pork and poultry dishes.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah.
How to drink. Cold.
Well, over ice.
Because you're not having a nice, like,
find a store near you. Indiana only. Don't live in Indiana?
Wow.
We should.
You should go.
My parents can snag some.
Yeah.
Indiana just did some new lockdown stuff. I think I'm screwed on that front, but maybe I can buy it. Can I get Rob a subscription to the cotton candy wine in which I know
son of a bitch
he does not want it, but it shows up every month.
What are you gonna do?
Regardless.
All right. Time that is. 45.
Hold on.
There. Yeah. I'm here.
I got it. I can do it.
45.
All right.
Nice.
Very exciting stuff.